This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Even though as followers of Buddha's way, we study the self, which is to say we study impermanence, I take a lot of things for granted. Every time there's an earthquake, I'm reminded of this. I take for granted that there's a stable earth. But of course there isn't really. And living in California, we get reminders of this from time to time. And usually, they're relatively gentle until they're not. And even the gentle ones are a suggestion that I study, that I've been taking for granted that there's a kind of stable basis. And of course, the geological basis is just a stand-in or a much larger kind of universal basis for the stability of all things, which, even after pretty much of a lifetime of practice, I don't know how often I look at that, quite frankly. Each time I sit down to practice with people, it feels kind of, solid in a way, or settled at least. And even when it feels unsettled, it's kind of a nice unsettled. Oh, this is nice. But the linchpin of the sentient being's existence is attachment. I think every Buddhist must admit that on some level. And for that reason, even in our Heart Sutra, which is the Reader's Digest version of an enormous literature of perfect wisdom. And there's, each vocabulary item in the Heart Sutra is pretty significant given how boiled down it is. The word fear appears. Well, strictly speaking, actually, it's not the word fear. The word that appears, at least in the Sanskrit, and some people have argued that, well, the Sanskrit is sort of invented from the Chinese. And then one person has argued that, well, the Sanskrit was invented from the Chinese, which was invented from the Sanskrit. So scholars go around and around with this stuff. I don't know how much that matters, frankly. But the Sanskrit word is, as I've probably said, having given I don't know how many Dharma talks in my life, I don't know, maybe some people have counted how many Dharma talks they've given, but I'm glad I didn't, because I might get discouraged. It's like, I must have started repeating myself quite a while ago. So I'm glad I lost count. Anyway, the Sanskrit word is atrasta, which actually means unaffrighted. So the word fear in particular doesn't appear. The word is an adjective meaning unaffrighted. And it describes a bodhisattva as being unaffrighted or unfrightened. And another, there's another adjective in there in the same sentence. The bodhisattva is described as acitta varanam. Actually, I think that's an adverb in that sentence, which is the grammar escapes me a little bit now, but in any case, it means having no coverings of thoughts. So, as usual, the meaning of that is has been debated for not just centuries but millennia. The perfect wisdom literature, in one form or another, having been around since before the beginning of the Common Era, I believe. But one thing it may mean, at least from the perspective of, our lineage and related lineages, is the world or our being or our existence beheld without the adornment of thought elaborations. Or as Suzuki Roshi might have said, things as just as they are. So without the elaborations of thought, the bodhisattva is thereby, or in that fashion, coursing in the deep practice of perfect wisdom. And in that sense is unafraid or unaffrighted. So this came to my mind a lot in the past week or so, because I, or this person, was affrighted a lot this past week because of some local disturbances, of which we talked last week in the Dharma talk, and some of us had, outside of the Dharma talk. And since then, they've actually settled down quite a bit, which is nice. But I was quite interested to see that it had been like a, for me anyway, a kind of serious earthquake. And some foundation, of which I hadn't been so much aware, had been rendered uncertain, really. And evidently some basis that I had been taking for granted without really realizing it had seemed to be threatened. And therefore, the entire world or universe had started to become a fearful place. So I was quite interested to watch this happening and to notice that circumstances that I might have considered quite innocent were suddenly frightening. Now, I don't mean to say that I was, you know, riding the Muni, gibbering in fear, or biting my nails, but I was interested to notice that if I was on the Muni and somebody sat beside me, I was afraid of them. Or if there were, I were crossing the street and a car passed behind me, I actually felt that that car perhaps would hit me. There are many, many, many examples. Or that if there were a one of San Francisco's less, shall we say, socially integrated persons were hollering something, it was a prelude to an assault upon this person. Now, none of this had much rational weight, so I didn't suddenly go, you know, ducking for the nearest doorway, but I was fascinated to watch that the texture of life suddenly assumed this quality of threat, which I was accustomed to from childhood, but not as an adult. So I was practicing quite a bit with fear in this past week, and it was very, very interesting to watch. And I realized that I had felt that there were many, many directions from which the sense of threat had proceeded. And I was meditating on, of course, the Buddhist list of fears, of which there are five. And, of course, any such list is to some degree arbitrary. And as I was meditating on the list, I thought I would modify it slightly. And from my own perspective, I thought, well, it seems to me that there were perhaps actually five, I would consider it fears of five losses. So there's, of course, loss of life, loss of livelihood, loss of reputation, loss of sanity, and then the last one I came to consider a little differently from the standard way it's presented. I started to consider loss of the ear of our fellow women and men. What you usually hear is something like fear of public speaking. And I thought, where did they get that? That just started to sound ridiculous. And poking around, I found other ways where that's expressed, which is something like fear of ridicule in the assembly. which is a little different from fear of public speaking. And then there was also something about fear of losing one's the ability to be heard in the assembly. And I started to think, oh, that's more like it. It's not fear of public speaking. It's fear that persons would cease to listen to one. And, of course, in our own city, I think if we look around, we see quite a few people to whom that has befallen. And to whom that has done great damage. So I've been contemplating these five fears of losses and seeing how visceral they are in the wake of just this, you know, relatively not so terrible earthquake we had in our sangha, and how it brought to light my attachment to my own situation, to my livelihood, to my reputation, to my perhaps sanity, perhaps even to my life, to the possibility of being heard in the assembly. Things which I had for some while maybe taken for granted. And as is always the case, as a result of the attachment, when the attachment was threatened, of course, suffering was the result. So to that extent, I must say I am grateful for the earthquake, which was not fatal, but strong enough to reveal the process of attachment and the necessity of finding some way to practice with that. And to bring to light the really extreme challenge that faces all on the Bodhisattva path, namely how to practice and care for beings, recognizing their and the Bodhisattva's own provisional existence without being led thereby to abandon those same beings. This is tricky stuff. In fact, it does not get any trickier than that in the spiritual life. So, this is really difficult. And I am enormously grateful to have others to practice with. So, I've renewed my vows. I'm in the process of renewing my vows day by day. Last thing I do, I think, before I go to sleep each night, I look at the four Bodhisattva vows that a Korean woman wrote in beautiful Chinese calligraphy up on my wall. I recite those vows as I drift off. And I feel that this last little period of challenge has sharpened my appreciation. And I thought I would confess how this challenge has also revealed yet more layers of attachment, and how the attachment has involved my attachment to you guys and this temple. And, well, it's kind of embarrassing, but there it is. still, this kind of practice is exactly what it's about, you know. The bodhisattva, all the bodhisattvas have received the gift of knowing. That's all right. Knowing what it means to knowing that it is possible to recognize the world without thought coverings, and to appreciate the kind of fearlessness that comes from that, or that rests on that, which doesn't necessarily mean the absence of some internal phenomenon that could be labeled fear. It's not what that means. Which is, I would say, why that particular Sanskrit word appears there, atrasta. A past participle. It's not a noun. Well, it is a noun, but it's a verb form used nominally. It's not one of the purely noun forms from Sanskrit that could have been used. It suggests to me that the bodhisattva is not afraid of fear. Therefore, he or she is atrasta. If he or she were afraid of fear, that would be another sort of covering. That would be being glamored by things as they are. But those on the bodhisattva path have, at least in some sense, seen through those glamours. And, of course, we're told, at least by some sages, that there are 10 stages of seeing through those glamours, all the way up to the one called Cloud of Dharma, where all you do is rain the gifts of Dharma on everyone and everything. I don't know what that's like, but I guess it's pretty cool. And presumably that's the you know, that's the peak of it all. But meanwhile, the gifts of your insights, if we can call them that, are freely and kind of spontaneously shared among all beings without your, you know, contrivance. You don't hand them out like cigars upon the birth of your children. It just happens. So that includes your having seen through the glamour of the apparent solidity of fear or anger or other afflictive emotions, or even the emotions we don't choose to call afflictive. ones that seem to lift us way up. Those are nice, but they too can be a kind of covering. So the bodhisattva is neither drawn way up nor dragged way down by these phenomena. And thus, when these phenomena arise, he or she is not affrighted. They just happen. So, in the midst of a world that suddenly had turned utterly threatening and scary, okay, now, it's going to sound like I'm calling myself a bodhisattva. I'm not. Okay. I'm actually... What?
I said, I'll go ahead.
No. I'm just a saying that after, you know, practicing a long while, I'm really grateful that I didn't... I may have thought of going home and putting the pillow over my head and whimpering, but I actually didn't. I managed to kind of do my day. You know? And primarily as a result of practice with people, I was able to cross the street, even though I thought that car is going to run me over. I know that person is going to kill me, you know, or the person on the other side of the street is going to take his umbrella and bash me over the head. You know, these various thoughts that occurred as a result of the universe revealing itself to be utterly hostile to my existence, just because of the stuff that happened last week, you know, which obviously had to do with stuff from much longer ago. From my having learned at age 2.5 that the universe was an extremely unreliable place. And yeah, I thought I'd forgotten about all that, but no, not really. You learn stuff that early, it stays with you. And something brings it up, well, there it is again. And as you grow into adulthood, and if you're fortunate enough to encounter the Dharma, you can integrate it in various different ways. And then when it comes up, you can, well, there's different things to do with it. And it can reveal itself as an avarana, that is a covering. And through practice, you can kind of see through those coverings and not be glamored by them. And you can be a trasta, that is, unaffrighted, and take the next step. Even if you're trembling a little bit in your extremities, you can still do it. So that's practice for you, for us. And I'm really grateful. So, I think this is no longer classified information. I had a meeting with a certain party yesterday with whom there had been a certain sharp conflict last week, and it was extremely nice and very sweet and very gentle. So I think that conflict has been defanged, so just so y'all know. That went very, very well. That too, I think, can be attributed largely to the workings of practice, a lot of which is mysterious, I would say. Anyway, that's how it looks to me. In any case, I think some of us are going to have a little meeting. Thanks to Peter here. Thought we'd get together for a while and talk about maybe some ways to put our heads together and pool our resources of practice and so forth when there is a sharp conflict, and see how we can maybe move more deliberately and constructively and quickly to head off damage to our community and each other when such things happen. We don't have any real like plan or anything, but the idea is to meet as a community and see what that can bring forth. And people are invited to join us and see what happens. Yes.
Are you invited even if you weren't partying in any way?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely.
This is not particularly about that event. This is about what resources can we bring to bear whenever such events may show themselves.
Can I add to that?
Yes, please.
Yeah. I would really hope that anyone in the community would really be would feel very welcome to come. Because what I see this as is a way for us to find a way to talk to each other skillfully. So please come. If you have any interest at all, please come. And we'll be meeting at 12:30.
What are those five losses again? What did I say?
Loss of life, livelihood.
Livelihood.
Reputation.
Reputation. Sanity. And loss of the ear of our fellow men and women. I'll still be meditating on those for a while. They are kind of intimidating. Especially that last one. There just seems to be, maybe it's me, but an awful lot of crazy people around. And they've lost the ear of their fellow men and women, many of them. And sometimes for good reason. It's like, what the hell are you saying? It's completely incomprehensible. Or utterly obnoxious. Or hostile. Or frightening. It's like, who wants to listen to them? Maybe that has something to do with it. So that makes it difficult, you know. It's not that hard to lose the ear of our fellow beings. If what you say is like, totally obnoxious. And, well, we don't have to listen to each other. So why bother? And then if you lose number five, you might lose number four, namely your sanity, since those two are kind of related. Sanity and community are very closely related. And then once you lose your sanity, maybe there goes your livelihood. And there goes your reputation. And then maybe there goes your life. You have some question? Comment?
Just one thing. When you mentioned that you had a meeting with someone that turned out well, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know who you're talking about. I wish you wouldn't say things like that.
Oh.
I have no idea what you're talking about, who you're talking about.
Okay.
And it just makes me wonder what in the world is going on.
Okay. Sorry.
I mean, I have some idea who you're talking about, but it's. I mean, please don't do that.
Okay. Why does that make you angry? Why does that make you angry?
Because I don't know what's going on. I need data. I have no idea what's going on here, and that does make me angry. Right, and I think rightfully so.
So, okay. So what makes you angry is that you don't know what's going on?
Yes. I don't, because of this. There's something about this right speech that tends to make us all just say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I really have no idea what's going on. I'm reading all this stuff. I have no idea what's going on.
Well, I'd be happy to tell you individually more. I just didn't want to say too much in this setting, is all. Mm-hmm.
Well, then don't say something like that. Okay. I had a meeting with someone. It's this mysterious thing.
Okay. Well, I'll have to use my judgment, but thank you for your comment.
I wonder, should I strive to not be concerned if I lose the ear of my fellow people? Or would that be a mistake? Mm. Is that something I need? It sounds like I need it. But if I want it, if I reach for it, mm-hmm. I won't get it. I'm just guessing.
Hmm. Well, it feels like something important to me to be in dialogue or to be in community. So, if you feel like that's something you might want or need and don't have, I guess I would wonder maybe what's happening to that, or where it went, or maybe don't care about it, in which case, all right. But if it's something that is important to you and feels like it's something's gone awry with it, then maybe that's worth looking at. But it's true, some people are quite content not to be much in dialogue. It does vary from person to person. So...
Okay. It feels like if people know I want it and I show that I'm scared I'm not going to get it, then they'll withhold it. Oh. It feels like that funny dance, like when you have a crush on somebody or you want someone's approval or something.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But am I missing it? Maybe it's not that at all. Maybe it's something else.
Well, if all the people we meet sense that we want to be in dialogue with them and therefore withhold it from us, then I think we're meeting the wrong kind of people. That doesn't seem quite right somehow.
I feel like I'm misunderstanding something.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe I'm scared or something. Or maybe it's the fear of losing.
Yeah. I've had periods in my life where I maybe thought that too. And sometimes I've actually paid people to communicate with me and check out how I was communicating. And sometimes that was helpful. Sometimes that was very helpful. Sounds funny, but actually, I've done that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In that particular fear, it seems as if the word assembly is what, for me, that's what's off-putting or off-throwing or whatever, uh-huh. because that being heard in the assembly is more like the reputation one, uh-huh. as far as my, you know, the way it strikes me. And the being heard part, that may or may not have anything to do with an assembly per se.
Uh-huh.
It's more like just having some place I can go with my feelings and my thoughts where I feel like, you know, I can be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be with one other person.
Mm-hmm.
But just having some place I can go with that stuff to, you know, whether it's a therapist or a friend or a mm-hmm. relative or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, that my community may be really small,
yeah,
you know,
right.
but still there's, you know, there's some place where I can sort of decompress
mm-hmm.
stuff
mm-hmm.
when I need to.
Mm-hmm.
And
rather than to have no ear at all that
yeah,
you can speak to.
To have nowhere.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And there have been times in my life when maybe that was only having a, you know, pencil and piece of paper. You know, or,
uh-huh. mm-hmm.
But, you know, that would sometimes be enough.
That was the ear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good.
And I might like tear it up and throw it away later.
Mm-hmm.
also going to say that about fear, mm-hmm. you know, that's a really interesting thing to study, and the most helpful thing I ever read about it was by somebody, I almost think of his name, I think he's in the yoga community, but that fear is usually, it's about projecting yourself into the future, you know,
yeah.
and it's all about what if this and what if that, and,
yeah.
you know, and so that, you know, the most kind of helpful remedy that this person was, you know, expounding was about just, you know, like the present moment being sort of the place from which you can get a better perspective or just kind of bringing yourself back into the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, actually, and that also relates to this other idea about, it's on a bumper sticker, it says worry is not preparation.
Right.
So,
right.
But if somebody's coming at you literally in that moment, you know, I mean, then your fear response is, you know, is actually useful.
Right. It's not preparation either,
it
really.
It stimulates you to do something.
Right.
But if you're only worrying about what might happen,
right.
then, okay, let's come back here and see what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is really something to be done about it.
Right. Yeah. Good.
Very rough paraphrase.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me try this one on and
mm-hmm.
see how it fits. I think if we do practice in such a way as to try to remain steadfast and yet open to things as they are, and we see as we go day to day to see how emotions arise, our thoughts arise, and if we're patient with them and compassionate with them, then we can see them fall away. Then when we have difficulty, either in ourselves, with a partner, with a group at large, then sometimes I think that there's something to be said for taking the effort to continue to work at it, to work with it, rather than to recede. And many of you know that I also go to a recovery group where we take a moment during these meetings to share how we're feeling about just about anything. And sometimes my sponsor will tell me, I want you to raise your hand, even if you don't feel like saying something, because there's somebody in that group, you don't know who they are, who needs to hear what it is that you're going to say. You don't know what it is. As it comes out, somebody in there, that's going to be some movement. That's going to be received somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to express my appreciation for being able to just continue in a direction and be able to see how things come about and see how gently things might be able to be smoothed out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thinking of what Rin said and what you've been saying about the unaffrighted, and just coming back to the present would be removing some veils of, you know, future and past. That would be creating a false view as well. And so then, you know, in that present moment, we know that, like, when something really bad is happening and we're right there with it and taking care of it, that we're usually not afraid of that, you know, in that worry, fearful way, you know, maybe really scary, but we're taking care of what needs to be done, like in a, you know, should we have an 89 style earthquake again or
mm-hmm.
anything like that. So it's very interesting. You know, and I think that was maybe the commentary of Satchidananda on the Bhagavad Gita, part of that, maybe what we were talking about.
But
it sounds very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But just that kind of. The present is not nearly as frightening as these other places we can go.
Yeah.
I want to lend a voice in support of fear. Fear is it's a biological survival strategy. Mm-hmm. And if the bear is running down the road at us full bore, we damn well better be afraid. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And because of evolution, we still are.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that one important element of practice is knowing what we should be afraid of and if the bear is chasing us now.
Yeah.
True. And bears come in a lot of different sizes.
They do. Mm-hmm. They do. Presumably the bears have not eaten all the cookies, so you can go have some of those now, if you like.